Welcome to Slovenology, the podcast with Noah Charney.
Thank you all for coming. This is way easier for me because I get to do this in English. I usually host these things in Slovene, which is hit or miss from a grammatical standpoint. Thank you all for coming out this evening. This is going to be a new monthly series. There are going to be 8 of these. There's going to be one in March and April, and then we're going to have more in the fall. March 8th, we're going to talk about food culture and cookbooks. And in April, we're going to talk about being a foreign journalist and what that's like. But tonight, we are talking about translation. And I have so many questions, I hardly know where to begin, but I have phenomenal translators here with me. I have Mojca Medveščuk, who translates from Spanish into Slovene, but you also know Portuguese and French, and you're a multi-talent. And Rolly Grau, who's a fellow American, whose grammar is way better than mine, probably in English too. And he translates from Slovenian into English. And Roman Hučan, who's been my friend for many years, and we've collaborated, and he is a brave Slovenian who translates from Slovene into English, among other things. So please welcome them. My first question is, how do you find your translation projects? Do you normally choose them yourselves, or are you contacted by publishers, or what's the process? And I'm going to ask the three of you more generally, and you can each give answers in turn if that's easiest. Mojca, so maybe you want to speak first?
Okay. Well, I'm going to be you in Slovene, so pardon my English. I was very lucky because from my first project I could choose my own project, and that's really a gift for a translator, not to translate out of necessity only, but also out of love and affection to a text. I started with French, which is my first language, and then I was lucky to also start to translate for Portuguese, which is also one of my key languages. And Spanish was luck. And yeah, now lately I'm translating a lot from Spanish, which was the third language that I adopted. Of course, when you start to translate and if the editors are more or less content with your work, then you sort of, they also call you, try to find you for the next project, which is also happening. It's not that I only go around and propose my project, but mostly these are authors that they know that I already did them, or they would want me to do them. And so it goes for novel and also for poetry.
Maybe while I have you, before we go to the other respondents, you could tell me just, so the audience gets to know you a little bit, what is a favorite book that you translated, or one that's maybe exemplary of the type of work that you like to do?
That's a difficult question.
And you don't have to say one of Pascual's books necessarily. Mojca has this superstar husband who writes books in Spanish, Carlos Pascual, and she translates those among other things, so you're not obliged to pick one of his.
Yeah, they are one of my favorite books, of course. But I have a French author that I really like, Michel Houellebecq, and I also, as a student, I was completely in love with Luc Lesieux, and I also translated, my first translation was his, actually, and later on he got a Nobel Prize, so I was very lucky, actually, to pick him, and he was not very well known in Slovenia, actually. They reprinted my translation when he got a Nobel Prize. So Houellebecq, for example, is a hard work, but I really love it because it's so our era, and for me he's a real challenge because his way of seeing the world is very different of mine, very, very different, but I still like to do this exercise, which is not only a mental and exercise, but it's really a big challenge to put myself into his head. Translators, we are very anonymous persons, So people are very surprised when they see me, and also the author was very surprised who is his translator in Slovenian.
Okay. So the first question was, how do I get my translation projects? Initially, I've been in Slovenia now for 16 years, and initially I had writers come to me who wanted to have their works translated, friends or people, friends of friends. And so, actually the first book I translated from Slovene into English was a book of essays by Aleš Debeljak, and that came about from happening to meet Aleš on the, it was something like the fourth day I was in Slovenia at a cafe, and we started talking, and then, you know, I suddenly found, after being here only a week or 2 weeks, he was asking me to translate a book of his, so that was quite nice. And then since then, once I, as you mentioned, once you get a certain reputation and people know that you do this, then you have different people coming to you and more from different projects. The last three, for the literary works that I do, I also do a lot of translation of, in general, in cultural studies. But for the literary works, the last three novels I translated were all part of an EU project that the publishing house Bellatrina was involved with Istros Books in London. And so they approached me for those.
Do you have a favorite among your translated books that will maybe...
Well, I should add, you mentioned I translated from Slovene, but I actually learned Russian a long time ago.
Okay.
And certainly my own personal labor of love was the translation I did of the poems and letters of the Russian poet Yevgeny Baratynsky, which came out a couple of years, about 3 years ago. So that has to be in first place because it's something that I'd been working on for 30 years and was truly a labor of love. And it was my own project. As far as the recent books, I think Dušan Šarotar's Panorama is one of the books. I'm proud as well of all of the books I've done. But that novel in particular, I really fell in love with, and it's an interesting thing. You do enter the author's head when you translate a book, and Dušan himself is such a beautiful poetic soul that it was. I remember after I translated that book, going to the seaside, because in Panorama. Much of the novel is taken up with descriptions of weather and the sky and the way water the way light falls on water, and I was looking at things in a completely new way through the eyes of Dušan Šarotar, and I found that an incredibly enriching experience. So that was wonderful.
Change of mics. Hi, good evening, everyone. So, no, I'm still being tested by the grant. So, people approach me and say, "Would you want to do this?" And being a freelancer, I say, "Yes, please." Otherwise, I would like to pack up my suitcase with pitch translations and go around and to various publishers or agents and show them what I can do or can't. But basically, I'm still new in the literary translation department. I'm more of a cultural sciences or researchers. But so basically compile various material that other people can use from Slovene language or other languages into English. So there's this really funny book that I was doing a couple of years ago. It still hasn't come out yet because of cash, I think. The developers haven't compiled enough cash because they want to do a facsimile. It's a late 15th century thing with a lot of painted pictures and golden leaf things and decorations, so it'll probably cost a fortune. So I've done some translations into English of various passages, and it was a fantastic thing about women fighting in suits of arms against dragons and stuff like that. Yeah, that's like a bit psychedelic. Yeah, and I think still I like this work just because of it. It's always something new, and in my case, it's like this very famous story about a glass, a big glass that you fill up with several big rocks. I still haven't translated any of the big stuff yet, and then smaller and smaller pebbles, and until you put in a lot of sand. And for me, that's translation of articles and, you know, a zillion of smaller stuff that you hope that at the end of the month it'll sum up in a decent pile of money to take home. But there's always enough space for beer.
I'm curious about your working process. I spent several years every week interviewing famous writers in English for a magazine called The Daily Beast, and I had the same questionnaire for each of them. And I'm not going to give you the whole questionnaire, but one of the things that I found most interesting is the modus operandi, how people went about their work, whether you need to wear a magic hat, or you can only work, you know, when there's a full moon, or with your hairless dog on your lap, which I have as one of my criteria, and also how much you finish in what you think is a productive day. So what does your working day look like when you're translating?
Let's go in reverse order.
Cool. Okay, I have an ideal working day. It's my day is 30 hours long, and I'm rested, I've had enough sleep, and everything is quiet, and nobody bothers me, and the words just come up like this. It has never happened so far. So I work as I can. I try to make enough hours in one go, so to make any sense of it. And sometimes, oh boy, I have a slow start. Sometimes I just cannot seem to get started. It takes half an hour, enormous quantities of coffee. No magic hats, though. Maybe that should help, some magic hats. But no, what I basically need is peace and quiet. That does the trick. And, well, sometimes at the end of the day, a lot of things are done. You know, just a pile of things that are useful. And there's days that you just want to rewrite everything. It just doesn't make any sense. So if you ask me, or actually as I'm listening to myself now, I'm a chaotic person, or creative. Well,
yeah.
What's the better pitch?
Both, I think. They're synonymous. Raleigh?
I wish I did, you know, live that ideal day as well, where it's all... A friend of mine once suggested that I go off on a retreat. She had translated a book, actually a good book by Lydia Dymkowska, if you know her. And the translator of that book is a friend of mine, and she said that she had done it because she had gotten some kind of grant to go off on a retreat somewhere, and it's like, wow, you know. So that's what I need, but because peace and quiet and being able to, as Maya said, to enter the writer's head and to stay there for a few hours is really essential. So in reality, I usually write in periods of a couple of hours, take a break of some kind, maybe a long break. Return if I always like to say that, you know, people ask me what I think of deadlines, and I find deadlines inspire me, you know. and it's true. So with the most recent work translations I've done, I've had very tight deadlines. And so I've had to pace myself and make sure that I translate so many pages a week and so forth, which... is a grueling process, but it's helpful. But it tells me that, so when it's 10 o'clock and I feel like going to bed, I say, no, I'll try to put in do a couple more pages, and sometimes I end up working until 3 in the morning, because that actually happens to be a very quiet and good time to work if I'm not too sleepy. So,
do you have a daily or weekly quota that you find is reasonable?
Well, it depends on, as I said, it depends on the deadline, and it also depends on what else, other obligations I have to do, because I teach as well and there are other things. But that helps if I can set myself this kind of weekly quota, which usually also means trying to get a certain amount done each day, or at least set aside days when I can do that.
Moitza, do you do flamenco dancing in between bouts of translation?
Yeah, of course I do. Actually, I love to go to dance when I translate. Actually, when I'm translating, I easily find any excuse not to translate. I don't feel like a real translator, really. I always think that people, other translators that I know, are much more dedicated, because it's a very monocle work.
Yeah.
When I was younger, I had an experience of a retreat 1 month when I was doing Welbeck. I got a scholarship, so I went to Germany for a month, and that was the ideal. That I never experienced, that never repeated in my life. And now, of course, when I start in the morning, then I don't have any routines, but I don't know when I translate, because I do everything else but translate, and when it's 8 o'clock in the evening, I say, okay, now I have to translate a little bit. And when I have deadlines, evening is a really good time for me to work. I can work very late at night when I'm pressured, and I can also not sleep a few days if I'm really pressured. But somehow I feel this peace that you need to do a work and thinking, and when you're concentrated, night is the time of the day that I can work, then I can work and function very well. But now, with years, it would be much better to stand and wake up and have this lovely morning without any interruptions. This would be the ideal, let's say, schedule.
Now, did any of you actually study translation formally at university? This is something that I've run into too. Slovenes, how many Slovenes are in the house, and how many aspiring Slovenes? Okay.
Aspiring Slovenes.
One thing that I found in Slovenia that surprised me is a fascination with certificates and degrees and pieces of paper that prove that you can do something. Because we Americans don't suffer from this. We think if you're smart and thoughtful and hardworking and you have some talent, you can do anything. And like, my father went to medical school and he studied English. And you know, you hope that like your heart surgeon went to medical school, but other things like translation that you can, like pretty much anybody can do. But Slovenes will often have this idea that if you didn't study something, you couldn't possibly do it well. And I haven't actually met a translator who studied translation, but I'm very curious what you learn when you do it. Do you teach it now?
I teach translation.
Could you tell us a little bit about how it's taught, and what we could maybe benefit from, where we should take a class in it, and how it would alleviate our occasional suffering?
Well, first, I'm not sure that translation programs, which have become, the reason why I never studied translation is because when I went to college, there were no translation programs, there were no opportunities to study translation. They've really only emerged in the last 20 years or so. And what they include is usually a theoretical side, you know, which is important about what it means to translate something. And it's a worthy topic to study in the sense of to do a scholarly approach to translation, to see, to compare originals and translations and understand what was changed in the process of translation, and those kinds of questions can be fascinating. And I like sometimes reading those kinds of analyses of translations or comparing different translations of the same text, that sort of thing. And so that's something that happens in translation programs, that you approach translation from that theoretical perspective. What I teach is sort of the practical side of that, and I teach all of my students are pretty much all of my students are Slovenes at the University of Primorska, and so they take classes in learning how to translate into Slovene. They take practical classes for that, but I couldn't teach that. I teach them how to translate into English, which is really more about them learning some of my tricks for changing Slovene into English and hoping that some things will become clearer. And
could you give us a couple of them? Because now I'm fascinated. A couple of tricks.
Well, I mean, a long time ago when I was learning Russian, there was a point when I was speaking Russian and I realized that I had stopped speaking English with Russian words and I'd started to speak Russian. And the difference between those two concepts of speaking a language simply because you're translating it in your head, the words in your head, and you're actually speaking a language more like a native, is something I call the genius of the language. It's being able to find that characteristic of the language, that spirit that lies within the language that it does. For example, in English, one of the basic things I try to teach my students is to use gerunds and participles more. In Slovene, the gerund in Slovene it still exists, but only in a very...
Those are the ing forms of verbs, if anyone wasn't sure. Yeah.
Right, right. You know, it only exists in sort of fossilized form in words like glidena, for example. And in English, it's still very much we use it all the time. And so in Slovene, you might say, have a sentence where she read the book, she read the article, and then, you know, made dinner. And in English, you might, I'm not saying this is the best way to translate that kind of sentence, you might want to say, having read the article, she made dinner. That kind of thing. And so that's part of the genius of literary English, of written English anyway. That's more of a written thing. So that's one thing, to get them to feel more comfortable using those kinds of things. Another important difference is just sort of understanding the logic of the sentence. I was just talking to someone the other day about how in Slovene you tend to put the most important thing, the new element, at the end of the sentence. And it doesn't matter if that's the subject of the sentence, you can do that because it's a Slavic language, and Slavic languages do that, and it's easy to do it. In English, you can't just turn the sentence around and put the subject at the end. You have to find other ways to make that the emphasis, and so you use other things, which right now I'm not going to remember, but for example, it was the table that interested him, mm-hmm. instead of saying, you know, or he was interested by the table, but which is not as interesting a sentence as it was the table that interested him, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
What about using translation assistance software like Trados? Is that something that any of you use or find useful?
I never do. I don't know how to do it.
Okay. So we're all
old-fashioned.
I guess the next question would be, in what way do you feel that you taught yourself how to translate if you didn't have a course in it, or was it just immersion and experience?
Yeah, for me, definitely, it was an experience. And as my colleague said, even that I'm younger, at the university we didn't have a translation course while studying. We had some practical, let's say, courses, but they were not, I'm translating mostly some of it nonfiction and literary things. So there is no course for that. You have to start if you want to do this. And of course, you need a lot of courage and enthusiasm, and you just have to start. And the good thing, and I think it's the most important thing, is to have a good editor that guides you. This is the most important thing, so that he sees and recognizes this first errors that you make, and you know, he somehow he's your guide. This is the most important person, I think, in the process. And if you have a good guide, then you can really learn well. If you're alone, it's not that. I think it's not that you don't progress as if having such a person. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah, experience, I think, that's the main key with me as well. Actually, now if I really want to go in search with the roots, I think it's the necessity of communication, because living in a small country and so on and so on. Well, I spent my childhood in a small town. It's a beautiful town that stories are made in, a huge castle, vast forests, a couple of big rivers conflicting together. I mean, it's, something that you want to live.
Yeah, it sounds good, yeah.
Yeah, but the thing was that there was, the Yugoslavia, the time of Yugoslavia, and there was a lot of military there that came from the other parts of the country, which was bigger than Slovenia, a lot bigger. And we just spoke languages. I think that I don't speak Albanian and Macedonian, but the other languages from Yugoslavia were just like natural. So I think this is where it started. Mm-hmm. Reading different books, talking different languages, sort of lack of fear of that. And being a hard-headed yokel, saying, oh, there's something, and maybe let's see what it sounds like in other languages, in other way. Let's rewrite or tell the story. Yeah, of course, I probably made zillion colossal mistakes. My first literary translation was failure. Yeah. And the editor said, no. And I agree with you, a good editor is a treasure, that's an asset. But then, I believe that there is also, every translator has a toolbox, the tools that have to be used. And of course, I don't use the software, as you said. I'm more of a, paper and pencil. Okay, I upgraded to a keyboard now. But I do search through the vocabularies, I do search through encyclopedias and stuff like that, because it's a different kind of treasure than any of the software could offer me, as far as I know them, as I'm aware of them. Maybe there are some that are really super duper, but I'm not aware of them. That and the best tool that I got, that I use all the time, I think I was taught that in a theology course. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how to look at the text, how to look at a story. This is not going to take long, I promise, even though it's a theology. I see that people go like... No. It's just that basically there are three planes, and the plane of the text, so that I see what a text is like. Is there a certain specific form I need to follow, or that tells me that I need to follow it? What does it look like? What register of a language it speaks in? I find all this very important. And then there is a plane of the text, the plane behind the text, because every text, every story is rooted into something. And the more I know of that background, the better I am in understanding the narrative, the story, the message. And that means the better I can put it forward to the plane in front of the text, to my audience. And of course, this is again very important, because I have to keep that in mind. Whom am I addressing, or my translation should address? So basically, it's a mess.
My next question is maybe it's twofold but combined. One is, how much freedom do you feel you have to stray from a direct translation of the sentence and to take the sentence's meaning but to present it in a different way as opposed to translating sort of word for word. So how much freedom do you have? And part of that question is, if you've ever had to translate a text that you really didn't feel was written well, do you feel like it's your responsibility to improve it? Or do you literally translate as you see with the knowledge that this really could be written in a better or clearer way?
Moitzi, you want to start?
I can try. The first part of the question was, I wasn't following very well.
No,
I
sure.
I think that you are asking us if how free do we feel?
Yeah.
Well, I don't feel free at all.
Okay.
I just feel very responsible always. I think this is, I don't know, from when I started, I just felt this incredible responsibility that everything would be, would sound it as it can sound in my language, of course, because I mostly do the translations from other languages to Slovene. It's and I still feel it, this responsibility. Freedom comes, of course, in the way you feel your language. As you said, you cannot translate, and I think we all know that, literally. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't work, as my colleague was saying, that you cannot use the same order. There are many things you cannot do because it sounds just ridiculous or rigid. No? You have to find the voice and the, how do you say this, govorica, mm-hmm. How do you say this in English?
Yes, so the manner of speaking or the sound.
Exactly.
Yeah,
the manner, the sound of speaking. And each voice, each writer has its own, and this is the most difficult thing. If the author doesn't write well, this is really difficult for the translator. I think this is the most, when you say, but he cannot, if you don't understand what if he's saying, if you don't understand because your language is not good enough, okay, this is okay. But if it's really badly written, then this is mission impossible. I mean, you cannot, and I never correct. I just leave it like that.
Yeah.
And if the editor that said, but this, you cannot understand this, I say, okay, but this in the original, you also cannot understand this. And you can see that, you can change that. My experience was very different when I started to work with Carlos, because there I have absolute responsibility, but I also have absolute liberty. And the only translations that I really feel free, or at least responsible but free, is with his text, because he also permits me, and I have an official permission, I can cut... I see the phrase that I don't like, so I said, I won't translate that. And his first experience with me was really traumatic, because I just didn't translate the whole paragraph. I just let it out because I said, this is not important. And he was very shocked.
Oh, okay.
But this, but it was not because I didn't want to or that I felt free. It was just that the text couldn't fit in the, in the layout.
Okay.
It was a technical
okay,
problem.
Okay, fair enough.
Not, I don't do that. I'm always very interesting also in interested in how my colleagues do that in other languages. So when I translate classics, for example, I often see English translation or American translators, and I can often see that they, when they don't understand, they just, leave it. Or if it's too complicated, they explain it too much.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, but in Slovene, we don't have this tradition. It's more like Russian, more like Central European tradition is really to, be very, to follow the text, not to explain too much where... If the reader doesn't understand it, it's because the author wrote it this way.
I've had a lot of different experiences with this, and I think when I started translating fiction, I had an idea of translating in a way that would, and it comes from Benjamin's essay, The Task of the Translator, which I think probably can be very dangerous for a translator to read. But his idea there is that when you translate, say, I think from, it was a case of from French to German, Baudelaire or something he was talking about, then you should, what's the word, Frenchify the German. And so I had this idea that I should translate in a way that sounds, in a way, Slovene. It's English, and it's good English, and it's clear, and the reader can, but it's not going to sound the same way as if I were translating from French or from Russian. They would sound like French writing or Russian writing. And I actually had that experience when I was translating these letters by Baratynsky, because about 30 of the letters out of 160 or so were written in French. And so it was, you know, there's a different relationship between French and English. So that I thought I would see if I could do something so it sounded like they were originally written in French in some way. So the question of how closely do you follow the original, I think, is not a naive question. It's one that deserves thought. And it's not enough to say, well, of course, I'll always adhere to the original. Because there are, in fact, times when there might be something which, you know, just wouldn't make sense in English if you followed the original, and you then, or that it wouldn't capture the right tone. I always do try. I have a lot of respect for the original. I also have a lot of respect for word-for-word translations. I find that with my students, a lot of times the problems with their translations can be that they are, they try to get away from the word-for-word translation, when a word-for-word translation might, in a certain case, be a lot more clear, direct, and perfectly good English, whereas they'll end up making something maybe more flowery in English, or they'll want to show off the brand new idiom that they learned, you know. And you can feel that the translator is trying to show off in a way instead of actually listening to the text. One of the things I teach my students, I try to emphasize, is the importance of trusting the author. And I think that I might be going, you know, speaking a little bit out of turn, but I think sometimes Slovenes, when they're translating from Slovene into English, especially when they're young translators, they're very enthusiastic about English and less enthusiastic about Slovene. There's a tendency, I think, among to feel like maybe Slovene is not such a good language as English is. Maybe it doesn't have all of the great resources that English has. Maybe it doesn't have all of the neat words that English has. So I like with my students to sometimes compare something and to show how the Slovene, even when you give a good translation of it, the Slovene has said this so much more concisely, so much more clearly than English, you know, where you maybe needed 3 or 4 words in Slovene and you need 10 words in English to say that. And so I try to say, well, look here, Slovene 1, English nothing, you know? It's like, Slovene is, and I try to get that into their heads, that Slovene is a rich, beautiful language. And that sometimes English has to struggle to keep up with it. And so I think that's an important point to make in this regard. So I do try to trust the author, to follow the original, even if sometimes I feel like, I remember in one translation, again with students, the author kept repeating something. And it was something like, spät je to, spät je to. It was, again he did this, again, or again she did this, again she did that, or she did this again. And they kept wanting to change that. So first time it was, she did it again, she did it once more, she did it another time, you know. And I said, why are you changing it when the author has clearly created a rhythm in the language of repeating this word spate, spate, spate? I mean, there are other ways to say that. It's not like Slovene doesn't have other ways to say spate. So that's important, not to think that you know better than the author, that you are a better writer than the author is. Now, there are times when I've worked with writers or with authors who, usually not literary authors. The literary authors I've translated have all been really fine, really excellent in their own ways. So, but there are sometimes in some of the other, I remember once I was translating an author and it just didn't make sense to me what she was writing. It was an article about art, contemporary art. And but that wasn't the reason it didn't make sense. Come on. There's a lot of intelligent things that can be said about contemporary art, and you don't need to move into the area of nonsense. And I always, when I'm working with an author, I always use a lot of comments, sometimes too many, probably more than they'd like to have to go through. But I said, is this really what you want to say? Because it doesn't, I don't see the logic in it. And she wrote me this beautiful, and then I suggested how I thought it should be. I thought this might be what you want to say. She wrote me this beautiful note of, you know, thank you for straightening out my nonsense.
Okay.
So she was very gracious about it. And that's generally been the reaction I've gotten from authors. Even some of these excellent literary authors, when I've pointed out maybe something didn't quite make sense, or that sometimes in one case someone was talking about something, and sometimes she would use the word veranda and sometimes she would use the word terraza. And I said, are you talking about the same place, or are these two different places? And she said, oh, you're right, it should just be terraza. You know, it was, because I think, and again, I hope I'm not being too critical, sometimes in Slovene publishing, or it's true in American publishing too, but you talked about having a good editor, sometimes the original books have not been well edited. And there have been times when I've pointed something out to a writer, like Moitza Kumerde, I said something which, where some things were repeated and in her novel, and she just sort of, oh my God, how did that get through, you know? So if you can develop that relationship with the writer, then you can bring it to them and say, especially if they know that you respect them as a writer, and you're not just being critical and saying, why did you give me this junk to translate? You can ask them, you know, did you really mean to say this, or are you, do you want to say it in this other way?
Freedom at translating. Good one. Yeah, as both of you have already stated. I think it depends on the goal. What's the purpose of the text? What does it try to convey? As I'm trying to assemble several examples listening to you two, just to, for example, I was trying to help with the translation of a web page, and you know, the web page is slightly particular because it hangs on certain words, it hangs on certain keywords and so on and so on. So you basically work your way around it, like a stream and various whirlpools, and you have to sort of find your way through it. And this was an English-Slovenian thing. And because it's a web page of an artist, of an artisan, and in one of the segments, he wanted to sort of deliver the message, the rhythm of his small hammer hammering out, so that words that had to follow a certain rhythm. It didn't work. It didn't work. So we had to twist things. We had to cheat. You know, just, I definitely said, let's kill several keywords and just replace them with something else. We'll just link the page to, you know, the other page, so people will be okay. But yeah, the important thing was to stick to the rhythm of the hammer, of this sound. rather than convey the facts that were written before. Oh, then on the other hand, sometimes once I was helping with a screenplay. I would love to do Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead by Tom Stoppard. I would love to do it. But hey, no, it was something else. But still, it was the author was ambitious enough to go and try the iambic pentameter.
Okay.
Well, it didn't work. Yeah, because, well, and what the author has done was, oh, if it didn't fit, let's cut it. So, you know, just throw a vowel out, say something. They will, you know, it'll just look artistic. Well, yeah, it looked artistic, as in, we didn't get it. Okay, so if the author is fine with it, if the people who actually commissioned the work are fine with it, then I should be fine with it, even though I wouldn't like it. And then also I use the comments option a lot, and then I think it leaves me with this possibility of saying, look, I gave you the piece of my mind, what I think in my own capacity. I hope I'll get better someday, but now this is what I think about it, and you know, it's up to you whether you use it or not. But the hardest author to translate so far was me. Things that I sort of recycled. Now we're compiling material for the catalog, for a catalog of the exhibition from the last year. I was the co-author, and we have a bunch of text. I mean, I'm not going to write about things again. I'm just going to, you know, get it and translate it, something like that. And now, when I took a peek at that, that was ridiculous. So I'm going to rewrite it anyways. I was privileged enough not to come across a lot of bad writing at all. So maybe I don't have a lot to say about bad text. And I'm in awe with some originals. What that I'm reading, for example, not for my work, just for pleasure. I'm still amazed by, for example, just Terry Pratchett. Terry Pratchett is something that, you know, I was a bit younger when I started reading him, and it was, gosh, how would this sound like in Slovenian? I have no idea how to work my way around it. And some of his works have been translated to Slovenian. For example, Boštjan Gorenc Pižama, he did a wonderful job. So what he did was, for Good Omens, he studied the older registers of Slovenian, and then, you know, at some point when Shakespearean invented several words, and they work, you know, they just deliver the package. So it depends on the experience. I presume also a lot of coffee and some magic.
A couple of you have already addressed this, Moitz and Raleigh, but I'm curious about when you had a relationship directly with the author you're translating, what form does it take? And you talked about writing marginal comments. I interviewed Moitz Kuma de last month, and she just had the best time ever hanging out with you and working on things together in person. She thought it was really nice when you're in the same space working on things together. What's the sort of dynamic that is ideal for you when you've had the chance to speak with the person you're translating? And you might have a special romantic dynamic that is either more complicated or less complicated, depending. Do you want to start with that?
Yeah. Well, I will start with something else. For example, when I first saw an interview with one of the first authors that I was translating, with Michel Houellebecq, he sounded for me so impossible that I never communicated with him, but I went the other ways. I talked with an editor or other translators actually, but I didn't want to speak to him in person and have a contact. Then I met him, and now this is an easier relationship. But I never had the need to do that. I was also very stubborn. I wanted to solve things out by myself. Then I have a lot of experience with dead authors. So there's no way to have a communication there. And in that case, of course, these noted scientific versions of text are really And then we are so happy about them that they exist, because they give you an insight to one period that you were not part of, that you didn't make part of it. And in the last years, yeah, I have this wonderful opportunity to work directly with an author, which is now my husband. And this is for me that it's very. It's a very intense relationship, and also incredibly beautiful, because in a way he also adjusts a little bit his text, because when I'm reading I can sometimes say, I don't know, I feel that this is I don't know, repetitive, or it doesn't say a lot, or if it's not precise enough, exactly what you comment to your authors when you're translating. But he also has this luck that, no, he can redo or rewrite, and he says, no, don't say me anything else, I will rewrite it and you will understand it. So he does, sometimes he explains me, but sometimes he just rewrites things. And sometimes I also ask him to write something else or to enlarge, so the text would be more, I don't know, maybe sometimes I feel it needs an ending or another ending, or no. And sometimes, of course, I'm wordless, speechless. it helps me a lot, because he can sometimes, of course, sentences have this have double meanings. They have words and they have another meaning. And if I sense that, of course, he's there for me to ask him, and I feel very lucky about this. I also had another interesting experience after now 5 years of translating his text very intensely, because he writes a lot for the newspapers also. I can already feel what he thinks, and maybe it's not that obvious for the other Spanish-speaking person. So when I didn't have time last year translating his book, we sent one text to another translator, one of my students, and she had questions in the margins, in the places that I completely knew what he meant, but of course she doesn't know his way of thinking and the context, so she was completely lost, and that was my checkpoint, and I saw that the conversations, talking about some stories, anecdotes that he's telling me while we have breakfast, and then he writes them, of course I understand them, because I already hear them, and this is different when a story is told or an anecdote is told, and then you read it, you know where it comes from and where certain accents, irony, humor comes from.
Yeah, working with Moitza was wonderful. I mean, Moitza Kumede. And there were actually places where she didn't rewrite the book or rewrite passages, but she might tell me if there was something that was maybe confusing, or even, she'll just say, not a lot, but an occasional sentence, she might say, well, you can just leave that out. So... And I've come across other cases where the author has said that, even with a published, well-received book, they'll say, you can just leave something out. I mean, I wouldn't do that on my own. Sometimes I will suggest adding something to explain something, or to make a transition maybe a little bit clearer for the English reader. And usually the author... If I have understood what they're doing, sometimes it might be because I don't really understand that, and then they'll explain to me what they were trying to do. So it's a rich experience to work with authors. I've had the experience of working with a dead author, Baratynsky, but he was someone that I'd studied intensely for many years, and reading his letters and his poetry, and as much as I could about him, he began to inhabit me in a way. And so in translating there'd be times I would feel like he was, you know, looking over my shoulder saying, oh, I would never say it like that, you know. And so there is that kind of experience. But that just points to the fact that it always helps if you know the author well. And I don't mean knowing them personally well, but knowing their work well, knowing their style, being able to sense what they mean, the way they use words. And that can come just from translating a long work of theirs. You start to realize, oh yeah, when they say this word, that's what they mean. And you might not translate it literally in that sense, because you know that they don't mean it in that literal way, or that they're using a word in maybe a somewhat unusual way. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly happened. Now I'm translating another book of Moitz's, a collection of short stories, and certainly the experience, which was earlier than her work, but you can see that she's using the same, I mean, her language is hers, is very much hers. She has a very idiosyncratic way of writing.
So it sounds very beneficial for one translator to translate the complete works as much as possible.
Well, to immerse yourself. Even if you're not translating the other works, at least to read them. I mean, I found that with other writers when often too late sometimes. I've translated something and then I will start reading another book of theirs and I'll say, oh, that's what they meant with using this term or this word, and then you can't really go back. And that's the sad thing about having your translations published, is that you can't change them.
Definitely, connection to the author is the best way to understand things, if the text does not deliver, or just to double-check if things have been understood. And yes, in my perfect world, when I'm rested and had enough coffee and everything, I would come with the material, I would have read the work, I would come with the material, and on the other side of the desk would be the author, and then we would arm wrestle around every idea and around everything, because I need to understand. This is my starting point. It's like how many translators does it take to change a light bulb? Depends on the context. Yeah, so I need to get around this. And if the author is there, fine. If the author is not there, then I would like to speak to the editor, please. Degrades, possibly moves the meaning, is something that I might not reach as easily as in a conversation with the author. And at the end of the day, if no one is available, then I need a designated member of the audience. You know, come on, let's look at this. I don't think I've ever been brave enough to just do the kamikaze and just go for it. I think this is it. Let's see what happens. Or I just don't want to admit it. But this is how it should look like. And I think I prefer a conversation, exchanging words, rather than exchanging written material, because it saves time, if it's possible. And sometimes the authors are dead. There was an example of I'm a storyteller sometimes. This dude has been dead for about 500 years. It was great stories, everything. But there's just one page in the material where there are only two words, but they connect the narrative. They are very, very needed to bridge this gap and get the meaning. And the words were from above and from below. Oh, there we have it. But we needed to get through somehow. We did, hopefully, in the end. I don't know. Nobody got killed in the process. I mean, it's about sword fighting, so if nobody gets killed in the process, that's a good thing. I hope this answers your question.
Yeah.
I think.
I'm just going to ask one more question before we open it to the audience, because I'm sure there are folks with questions for you. But my experience, I've only
technically translated one actual book, which is Goran Vojnovic's Yugoslavia, My Fatherland. mostly what I'm doing is editing things that were translated by non-native speakers and basically massaging the text and often rewriting whole sentences. But I find that there's certain things that Slovenes translating into English or writing in English, common mistakes that are made that I'm always correcting, no matter how good the translator is. And one of my colleagues, who some of you may know, Jason Blake, who's a Canadian professor at Filozofska fakulteta, has a book that's free online, and it might be of interest to you. It's called 101 Mistakes in Slov English. So as many years of teaching English literature to Slovenes, he gathered 101 examples of mistakes that Slovenes in particular commonly make when writing in English or speaking in English. And it's interesting because it's tailored to a certain linguistic background. And he's got lots of examples in it. It's very funny. It doesn't sound like the kind of thing you'd be for fun, but you actually could. So my question is, what is the most difficult thing for you to do when translating between the languages you do, either grammatically or theoretically or logistically, if there's something that's the most challenging thing for you? And then please think about questions, because whenever I teach here, Slovenes don't want to ask questions. Do you ever notice this? There's the absolute silence afterwards, but you're not allowed to leave unless we have three good questions. So think about it. Okay.
What's the time? Oh, that's a difficult one. I don't think any examples, really good examples, pop up now. Besides the usual vrata, doors, mužgani, brains. And obviously there is a certain type of humor that people accidentally bump into, and everybody's just snigger. But I'm not going to tell them that. We're not there yet. I just can't think of any really good examples of that that would be really memorable. And you know, I mean, it's like in IT, mm-hmm. if there's a problem, you solve it and then you forget about it because it's not a problem anymore.
Fair enough, yeah.
Because if it happens again, you know what was the deal and you just sort of forget about it. So, yeah.
Okay.
Well, you mentioned vrata. I mean, these things like that. Another thing in those in that line is translating roka and noga. Mm-hmm. I will, at times there'll be something where it describes someone who raises his roka, and I'll ask usually another Slovene, I'll read it to them and say, is he doing this or is he doing that, you know? If it's clearly written enough, they should be able to tell me.
I was worried that a surgeon is going to read that they have to amputate a roka and it's the hand or the arm, and how do they know?
there are those lexical problems, but it's more some of the things that I said earlier, is how, like in sentence structure, where is the emphasis fall? How do you move? And trying to catch the author's logic, the logic of the paragraph. And the logic, this is particularly true when you're translating scholarly texts as opposed to literary texts. Sometimes it can sound like and I've also dealt with translations from Slovene into English by non-native Slovenes, and I've often noticed that they sound very clunky. They sound like the writer is keeps changing the direction they're going in, essentially. And I think that's because the translator hasn't understood how the fact that Slovene sort of points in a different way than English does sometimes. And so you can make it sound perfectly normal and logical simply by reordering the clauses, the phrases that are using, or An example too is words like you know, these conjunctions like tsitser, or words like tsitser or pa, and this kind of thing. Sometimes you don't have to say it was this, but it also did that, or you can say although it was this, it did that, you know, and you can just makes it a more flowing English sentence. Whereas if you translate it, you know, taking into account every word of the Slovene, it becomes stilted. That said, I often use as part of my method, and also my method of teaching, but also my method when I'm trying to work out a complex Slovene sentence, is to begin with a word-for-word sentence, so that I can know that I can know also that my students clearly understand things. It's very interesting teaching Slovene students, because I also see sometimes they do not understand the Slovene text. There was one situation, I was translating a newspaper article, and it was a word, a feminine word that was in the genitive because it had been, it was in the genitive because it had been in a negative, in a negated sentence. Right, it's all very complicated. If you know Slovene, you're following me. And almost to a student, everyone translated that word as a plural. And I said, and I don't even remember what it was, what the word was. It was like ambulanta. And it was like, is there more than one ambulanta that they're talking about here? Why are you putting that in the plural? More than one doctor's office here. And then you could see the lights sort of going on their head, in their heads, that that was a singular genitive instead of a plural feminine, you know, a singular genitive feminine rather than a plural feminine. So you have to be aware of those things, and you have to, grammar is so important. Not just the dvojina, but everything, these subtleties of grammar, subtleties. I've corrected translations where the person was confusing who was talking because they didn't notice that in some cases it was reko, in some cases it was rekla. And so, you know, little things like that. So you have to be aware of it's not enough to know English and to know Slovene sort of good enough, but you really have to sometimes do a grammatical analysis of the sentence. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I work with other languages. Yeah, and it's the same. And what you said, course, in others, a lot of times you have this problem with the same in English. No, in Spanish is the same. In Portuguese is the same. But for me, the biggest challenges are concepts that doesn't exist because of the different cultures, and you cannot translate them, or you cannot, you can just describe them, or you can just, or you have to do this note, you know, that most of the translated, I mean, I'm the translator that doesn't like them, but sometimes, yeah, you really have to do it, because there's no word for it. So the, I will just tell you a small, very simple example. In my last translation, which was, and this is the first time that I was doing a text that is from another really century. There's a simple, in Portuguese, it's a very simple word for gospa, mm-hmm. which is dama and senhora. And of course, I was using it very lightly as a gospa. I left dama by intuition. But then I spoke with a professor that came, and he said, yeah, check your translation, the dama and senhora, because this is very important in Portuguese, in Brazil society of 19th century, because dama could be senhora, could be gospa, but she could also be not dama, she could just be a courtesan. Uh-huh. So, no, this is a very, maybe very light example of how a very simple word is also a concept that it's not the same now, and it has another meaning and a connotation. Mm-hmm. And of course, the other word in Portuguese that is also not translatable is saudade.
Saudade.
Saudade. It's in English, I think it's somehow something like yearning, repenenie or copernenie, but it's also to be unhappy, to be to want to see somebody, all in one word.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it has different. A lot of different meanings, but it's just one word to describe all of these feelings, which are in Slovene we have this chrepenenje is just one part of it. It's an important. It's a quite a good translation, but still, it's also happiness to see somebody. It's such a mixed concept, and this is a very famous not translatable word in Portuguese.
This has been totally fascinating for me. I've learned a lot that I'm going to find useful to take home, so thank you. Who's got our first of at least three questions? Robbie, I know you have. Fire it up.
Okay, now I've recently got a really interesting challenge, which is a project about translating. I'm otherwise not a translator, and I'll be very grateful about your opinions. The first one is about names. If I take a text, let's say from Slovene, if you say, let's say, in Janez Kopinček je prišel k meni, da sva skupaj neki nadila. Ne? Now, to translate that, would it be right to say, and Johnny Kopinček came to me, and together we managed to do a lot, or would you translate it, Janez Kopinček came to me? Good. Because I wanted to do it in Johnny, because it sounded better for me, because later in the text, I only mention the name, and it's nice to have Johnny in there, and it's flowed nicely in English, but then I had a couple of comments by people, and they said, no, you cannot do that, that's not respectful.
Can I take that?
Yeah, the name, Johnny or Janice?
Yeah, I've actually gotten that question sometimes from my students, and even one of the first book-length works, fiction, that I translated, the author raised the question, there was a character whose name was Sebastian. The story took place in Ljubljana. And the author asked, why are you translating it as, why are you writing Sebastian with a J in there instead of just Sebastian? And I said, well, he's a Slovene. And that's the way that's the name of a Slovene, Sebastian, not Sebastian. So I would say if your Janis is a Slovene, then I would keep him as Janis. Otherwise, unless he goes by Johnny, and then you could come across that, and because there are people who like to call each other by English names, and so that's fine then. But if you were to translate that as Johnny Kopinček, I would say, well, this is a Slovene who likes to sport some English name for whatever reason that he has. So now there are other cases. I'm actually right now working on a story where the first line of that story is "Klub svojemu imenu Srečko ni bil srečen človek." And so normally a story about a man named Srečko, I would translate the name as Srečko, but with that, I could. So what are my options? I could say, despite his name, Srečko was not a happy person. Asterisk. The name Srečko comes from the Slovene word for happiness. But I decided, and I've done that kind of thing in some translations. I don't really like to burden a text with footnotes or endnotes, but I've done it when it's been necessary. I felt it necessary. But instead, I changed his name to Felix, which could be also a Slovene name. There's nothing un-Slovene about someone named Felix. And in English, most readers know that Felix is related to the idea of felicity and other things. So No need for explanations, and he's just become Felix in the story.
Yeah, there was with this main translating thing. We had it last year when it was the anniversary of the Soška Fronta, Preboj Soška Fronta, and when we are writing in English, we always use the Italian name of the river, Isonzo. Mm-hmm. And then somebody said, you know, we have a really nice name for a really nice river, Soška Fronta, Rika Soča. And then I think it was for that particular article, for that particular compilation, we started using Slovene name of the river. However, we had to put it into note because the historians, the English-speaking historians, always use the Italian name, so there had to be some bridge. The original sounded quite okay, and there was no need to translate it. However, then there are conventions that we have to follow. For example, we all know that we always translate the names of the royalty. Yeah, so you have princess. If Yanis becomes a prince, then you will have to become Yanis sometime.
Another question. Yeah, please.
First of all, I would like to thank you. I mean, I really enjoyed it. But I have more than a couple of questions.
Okay.
First of all, as a translator, you can say, I mean, translator have their own signature, like an author, for example, when you read their text, you say, oh, that is his signature. Or when you see the movie, say, oh, this is a Scorsese signature, something like that. As a translator, they can't have any signature in their text when they're translating. And other question I would like to ask, as you translate and always you deal with really interesting fiction, and it kind of sometimes can temptate you to write your own book. Came up in your mind to do that. And third things about translating the poem, which is I think you've done it, right? I mean, it's
translating
the poetry.
Poetry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I never understand how you can do that. I mean. Especially, I mean, for example, with Slovenian language, which is quite precise language, you have gender, you have, the one word even without sentences that can give you so many information, which for poem can be sometimes destroy the poem somehow. Yeah, I mean, because sometimes poem can confuse you and after that your imagination work more and you go further, right? For example, I mean, English doesn't have a gender, okay, does about time, has a more time, but doesn't have a gender, doesn't have a clones, cases, and this stuff. Mm-hmm. And this also, I'm wondering how we can do it. These three my question. Sorry. You want to...
I'm filled with opinions. I can...
Yeah, you can each take one, maybe. So... A translator's signature voice or signature.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I spoke a little bit, I think, about that. I don't feel like... I'm sorry. I mentioned it before. I don't feel very free to put my own signature. I only felt... The only time that I felt liberty is when the author permitted me to do something. So that's the only case. But... I agree with you. I think that maybe the question goes in that way. The translator is co-author in a way. No, he cannot invent and put sentences or omit sentences, but he's co-creating because it's, for me, it's like, you know, to see a picture, beautiful picture or not beautiful picture, and then you have tools, maybe not the same, that the same colors he has, the same pencils, the same sharpness, but you have to paint the same picture, not that the other person is seeing on the other side of, I don't know, the house, you know, with other tools, but the feeling has to be the same. This is like, I don't know, one example of it. And as for... And
also
other?
Writing your own original work.
And I don't have any, I don't need any, I don't feel any need to write.
yeah, I would just say one of the things that I've told my students is a translator is a writer who has no ideas of his own. or her own. And so, yeah, but that doesn't mean that you don't have a certain style of translating. And I'm not aware of that style. I mean, I try not to impose my style on the text I'm translating. But I'm sure that some research being done 25 years from now, if anyone is interested in my translations, they might go back and say, this is a typical...
Growlian punctuation.
Yeah, exactly, you know, whatever. This is the way he handles, long sentences in Slovenes. I mean, you do, you know, I've talked about my tricks and things, so they certainly are part of whatever signature I have as a translator. So I'm sure that a very careful eye with too much time on their hands would find stuff, yeah.
And what about the particular difficulties of translating poetry?
It's very difficult, which is why it's so enjoyable. And you're dealing with all of that, things you said, with things that are in the original language that are not in the language you're translating into, the target language, like the way non-animate words have gender in Slovene and Russian, and that might play a role in the poem. And in my translations of Baratynsky, one point, he was in one poem, he's talking about the soul, and it's very clear the soul is expressed as a she. And normally in English we don't use she for the soul. The soul is an it, believe it or not. But in that poem I used she, and I felt I was perfectly free to do that. It worked. That's the question that you have to ask yourself at the end. Does it work? Does it come, especially with poetry translation? And there's a lot more... In some ways, there's a lot more freedom in poetry translation than there is in prose translation, I think. Maybe too much freedom, in my opinion. I always try to keep as close to the original as possible. But and the poems that I translated were metrical, rhymed poetry, and I had to make decisions as to how much of that I would follow, how much I wanted to change to fit the meter or the rhyme, and I decided, you know, I worked out something in my head with that time with my poet, Baratynsky, staring over my shoulder from the grave. So, yeah. So.
I just remembered, a funny comic. It was, there were a couple of chameleons on a branch, and one chameleon was going away, and the other one was shouting, "Darling, please don't go. I can change." And I think this is how I basically see my role. And as you said, there is a piece of something. There's a work, and it can be as beautiful or as not so beautiful. But the translator is there to translate it, and sometimes perhaps interpret it to the audience. So we have to get the feeling through. We have to get the information through. We have to have the general experience through. And this is why at this point, I cannot see myself having this particular stamp of saying, you know, Roman was here, something like that. It's just, maybe if I start translating in acrostics, you know, so you just go through the first letters of each chapter and then spell something else, right. Maybe. But saying that, spelling things out, there is a nice, a level in between the ghostwriters, and it probably goes into to answer the second question. There are ghostwriters, people who write things but for someone else, yeah, either famous people or just, yeah. And if you read the novel by Robert Harris, the ghostwriter, there's even a film by Roman Polanski.
You wrote that?
No. No. I wish I would. It's clever. And there's a question, the ghostwriter, the protagonist, and someone else, they talk, and she asks him, have you ever considered writing a real book? And he says, ouch. Because a real book, a book of your own, really something that you would put your name to it. And yeah, I have zillions of ideas. He knows. I keep pestering him. And when I translate, I say, oh, this is cool, or this would not work, or I would do it this way. But I never seem to gather enough courage to actually, you know, cross to the other side. This is it, crossing to the other side. Maybe not such a, you know, apocalyptic way of thinking, but still. And the third question, I have very, very little, next to none experience in writing poetry, in translating poetry, but it did happen one time, and it wasn't really poetry of any elaborate form. It was basically a chant. It was a story set in pre-Roman historic times, but it was a chant that people danced to, and it had a certain meaning. And when I translated the meaning into English, there was no rhythm. The rhythm was lost. Nobody would be able to dance to it, especially as the song and the dance became quicker, faster and faster and faster. And then I cheated. And then I cheated with the Spanish rhythm of Bulería. Yeah, and I used that, and I tried, and I think it worked, because all the author never really noticed. Yeah, I don't know.
Since we had hybrid questions, I think we're running out of time, but I want to thank you very much for coming. Maybe you can ask some questions directly of the guests afterwards. It's great of you all to come out so much. Thank you three for being such great guests. If you haven't had Pochen Kufer and you want to come back for more, March 7th, we'll be here again with some foodies and food writers talking about cookbooks and cooking and Urpat de Kuchnia. And then on the 4th of April, we'll have international journalists talking about being a freelance writer and writing journalism and living abroad. And if you also want to hear my versions of this in Slovene on the 28th of January, I'm interviewing Ivan Spreitz and Božidar Slapšak, who are two famous archaeologists at the Kamnik Library.
Not January. 20th of January?
The 28th of, what month are we? February, thank you. 28th of February, yes, back in time I will be. And aren't you in March?
Yeah, we're doing a talk in March.
And I'm interviewing Roman and a colleague, and Roman is also an expert in the history of European martial arts, and he also practices it as a sport. And we're going to talk about European fighting techniques with demos, which sounds very cool. And what's the, I'm the worst publicist for, so what's the date that we're doing it?
I think it's 27th of March.
The 27th of March at the Kamnik Library as well. So you're most welcome if you follow our, for instance, Facebook pages, and you can keep you abreast of various activities. Volunteer, Robert volunteers to be your victim. Thank you once again, and have a very nice evening.
Thank you.